Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 103. I'm recording it on Tuesday, February 24th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 13. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at the Incompetech.com website. The title of this selection is Bright Wish, sort of a birthday song. The title of the podcast is Cash on the Sidelines Often Disappears into Nothingness. This podcast is another in a series that I've done, mixed in with those on other themes, on the theme of the ordinary investor asks a basic question about investing that has profound implications if answered properly. The granddaddy of these is the podcast I recorded fairly early on called When Prices Crash, Where Does All the Money Go? If you understand that one, you understand the ABCs of stock investing. And if you understand the ABCs of stock investing, you go sailing ahead of 90% of the quote-unquote experts of today. You go to the head of the class, and you earn far higher returns at far less risk. So looking at these basic questions is of critical importance. And the only unfortunate, it's wonderful. One of the wonderful things about discussion boards is it gives people a place to do this. Lots of people have these questions. Most of us do not understand investing as well as we would like to. And in the past, we haven't had any place to go. We could ask our friends, but most of our friends don't know the answers. But on discussion boards, of course, one of the bad things about discussion boards is you'll get a lot of people telling you the wrong answers. And that's a problem, especially when prices are at insane levels, because then 90% of investors have an emotional investment in not knowing the realities. And so at those times, of course, most of the answers you'll get will be wrong. More than 90% will be wrong, because if 9 out of 10 have a wrong understanding, that 90% will bully the 10% who do have a proper understanding into not saying what they know. So at a time when 9 out of 10 investors don't understand the basics, and of course when you're at the sort of price levels we were at from 1995 through the first part of 2008, that's always so. Otherwise you couldn't be at those. If 90%, unless you have something like 90% not understanding the basics, you could never get to such price levels. So at such times, you're going to have 90% not knowing the right answer to the question, but probably if the answers put forward, it's going to be much more than 90% that will be wrong. 99.9% will be wrong. Because the 10% who know, they're going to keep quiet. But the best you can hope for is they may sort of, maybe they'll encode, they'll try to tell the answer in code, they'll sort of dance around the question a little bit. So if you're able to sort of decode what they're saying, you might be able to figure it out. But I'm going to break the code. I'm a troublemaker. Who was it used to say that? A radiology doctor. He used to come on Vanguard Diehards and say, Rob is a known troublemaker. He's known far and wide as a troublemaker with a capital T. So I'm going to go ahead. I'm not even going to speak in code. I'm just going to tell you the way it is. As I believe it. As I've tried to learn through my research and talking to my friends on the various discussion boards and all this sort of thing. And putting my mind up against the mind of the quote-unquote experts. I don't believe anyone's an expert today, but I do believe we all have intelligence. The experts certainly do, and I like to think I have a little bit of it. And I think I can put my intelligence up against theirs and see if I can, combining the two, you know, the two intelligences and the two sets of life experiences, maybe I can come up with something useful. And then I can, you know, with all this modern technology, I can stick a headset on my head and pull up some Audacity software and, you know, go podcast, go viral on you. Anyway, the question is, where this came from is there was a guy at the Bogleheads board, and he was asking this question. Of course, what's been happening is prices have been going down for a long time now. Prices have been going down since January 2000. So prices have been going down for 9 years. But they started going down more seriously in late 2007. And then the downward movement accelerated very quickly in September of 2008. September and October of 2008, things were just dropping, you know, 1,000 points sometimes in a week or something. And then, I don't know, by election time, things had sort of stabilized, and things have continued to drift downward since, but not nearly at the same pace. Things are just gradually going up a little bit and then down a little bit. And that's, of course, as of today's date. And I don't know what, you know, by the time this podcast won't be posted, probably for 6 weeks or 7 weeks, because I'm so far behind. I've been recording more than I can post at the website. And so by the time you hear it, you know, we may be a bit lower, we may be a bit higher. But what happened when things started dropping hard, let's say, you know, there had been a drop from late 2007 until September 2008. So people were already prepped for nervousness. People were already anxious when those September drops came into effect. They were already nervous. Usually, a lot of times when a price drop comes in, people don't get too upset because they just, you know, they run. They seek cover in these cliches. You know, they'll say, oh, I'm buy and hold, stay the course, stay stocks for the long run, can't time the market. No, can't time the market. And that sort of gets them through it. But when the, you know, those trite phrases, those incantations, those magical incantations, those marketing slogans, what they really are, don't work as well after they've been tried and failed repeatedly, the magic pixie dust starts to wear thin, starts to wear off, it doesn't work. So when we got to September of 2008, people were trying the magical incantations, but they were not working as well as they have worked on earlier occasions because the power had already been eroded. So there was a sort of a desperate quality. When people were using these incantations in September and October of 2008, there was a desperate quality to it, to the use of them. But they did try. And one of the things that people would say, they'd be trying to buck each other up. This is what you get on a discussion board. This is why I say the only way to understand how investing works in the real world is to look on discussion boards, because you don't read, it's not an academic study. It's not an ivory tower egghead, you know, doing some model in a laboratory somewhere where he can do all kinds of things that would never happen in the real world. On a discussion board, it's people. And that's what stock investing is all about. Stock investing is 70% emotions, 30% numbers. And in order to understand the emotional part of it, you've got to understand people and how they interact. And you can see that on a discussion board. You can see it in real time. So it's a powerful way of learning how investing works, so I believe. So what you saw was people a little desperate, you know. They wanted to stick with the same, you know, failed approach. Passive investing failed really back in 1981 when the first studies came out showing that valuations affect long-term returns. But people, you know, it didn't fail in a practical sense because people had made money from it long after 1981, all the way up through the end of the 1990s. So people wanted to see it fail in the real world before they gave up on it, before they acknowledged the theoretical errors. they had to see it fail. They had to lose money before they were willing to really accept that it had failed and come to terms with it. And we still haven't come to terms with it, but I have hopes that we're working our way up to that. But in September of 2008, that was a key moment because people were prepped and they were scared and they were anxious and things weren't playing out at all the way they wanted to see them play out. And there was a dark sort of feeling. And people were jumping in to reassure each other. And one of the things they would say is, you know, they had this question, the one I mentioned earlier. Oh, when prices fall, where's the money go? All this sort of thing. But one of the things they would say is, oh, you know, this is a good thing. Because what's happening is all the scaredy cats. You see, passive investors like to think that anyone who invests rationally is a scaredy cat. So they say, hey, all the scaredy cats, they're cash on the sidelines. You know, they have money to invest. They've got 401ks just like us. They need to retire just like us. What they're doing is they're scaredy cats. So they don't understand the magical incantations. They don't understand buy and hold or timing doesn't work or stocks for the long run. They didn't hear any of the marketing slogans. They've been repeated 10 kajillion times, but they were busy and they didn't hear. They don't know. We're smarter. They don't know what we know. We know about the magic power. And because they don't know, they're scaredy cats. And because they're scaredy cats, look what they're doing. They're taking their money out. Maybe they're putting it in a money market. But hey, the scare stocks for the long run, prices will come back. And when the prices come back, the scaredy cats, then they're going to feel bad. And they're going to take that money on the sidelines and they're going to put it back in stocks. And wow, we're going to be rich because stocks are going to go up and we're not scaredy cats and we're going to be rich. And hey, baby needs a new pair of shoes. Roll those dice. I'm feeling lucky. See, I'm not describing what they say. I'm describing what they think. I'm describing the emotions. What they say is, they know that that sort of thing won't fly. That sort of thing doesn't sound right for investing your retirement money. So what they say is, I thought that I read a study at the Princeton University Annals of Investing Nomenclature and the Boglesphere minus Teapot Spectrum algorithm. What was that one? The Sharp Ratio informs us that cash on the sidelines will cause stock prices to go up in the near future if for those who are not scaredy cats. You know, this is the way they'll talk. They dress it up in science. What they're trying to do is they're saying, I'm a scaredy cat. That's what they're really saying. They're saying, I've got my money in this, and I'm a scaredy cat. I'm scared to death. My common sense tells me passive investing could never work, and now my eyes are telling me it's not working in the real world. What am I going to do? I've got only two choices. I could do what my common sense tells me and save my retirement, but that would mean I'm admitting I was wrong for the past 20 years. I've told all my friends this gibberish. I told my wife. She's going to have my head handed to me. We've been losing money in stocks for 9 years now, and I'm going to go home and tell her, honey, I was wrong. You were right all along. Common sense really does work in the long run. The money can't come from the sky. There's no... Oh, I can't do that. I know. I'll go to my friends, old bogleheads, and I'm sure they're going to have some sort of story that'll make me feel better. And I'll ask them, what happens to all the cash on the sidelines? Won't that help? And they'll say, yes, oh yes, cash on the sidelines will be coming back into the market. And then I'll feel better. And I'll tell my wife that and I'll print out the post. And it's okay. It's okay. See, there's always two things going on in stock investing. There's the official story, which is all the BS. Stocks for the long run, buy and hold, timing doesn't work, BS. And then there's the real world. The world where when you buy stocks at insanely dangerous prices, you always suffer bone-crushing losses. Passive investing has been tried 4 times in the history of the U.S. market. It delivered bone-crushing losses to all who followed it the first time. It delivered bone-crushing losses to all who followed it the second time. It delivered bone-crushing losses to all who followed it the third time. It delivered bone-crushing losses to all who followed it the fourth time. I'm beginning to see a pattern. So, but the question has to be answered. If you try to invest rationally, if you try to invest effectively, if you try to invest sensibly, there's going to come a day when you're going to be in a crowd of people. You know, it could be at work, you know, during a coffee break, or could be at people over your house, could be on a discussion board, and you're going to say, oh. You know, there's going to be a crash like there was in September, and people are going to say, well, what are you doing? You're going to say, well, I don't have money in stocks, or I only have a tiny bit, 10%, 20%, because, you know, prices have been insanely dangerous now for, what, 95 through 2008, 13 years. Prices have been insanely dangerous for 13 years, and I am not interested in losing all my retirement money. I'm thinking I'm going to wait until prices are reasonable, and the odds of a strong long-term value proposition are good. And then I'm going to go with a heavy stock allocation. But my thought is the more money I hold on to while prices fall, the better. And they're going to look at you and they're going to say, you know, this is the enemy. This is common sense. This guy's out to get me. This guy's trying to trip me up. He's trying to kill my pixie dust. This is an anti-pixie dust guy. He's one of them. He's a bear. I always thought he dressed funny. I always felt that he just had no fashion sense whatsoever. And those glasses are from, you know, where does he get these ideas? And, you know, he's just something not right about that fellow. Something not right about him. Betty Reed Schiller. Bet any amount of money, you check his bookshelf. He's got Schiller on his bookshelf. So, they're going to ask you this question. If you try to invest rationally, they're going to say, they're going to have to shoot back. They're thinking they want to criticize your glasses and they want to criticize your fashion sense, but they know that that's not really polite. And so they're not going to say that. They're going to say, well, did you ever think about all the money on the sidelines? There's money on the sidelines, you know. Money on the sidelines, that's going to make it go up because that's what my friends tell me. That's what John Bogle says and the Bogleheads and the Vanguard diehards and the academic research. And it says it's going to go up. It says money on sidelines. Money on sidelines is going to go up money. So, okay, buy and hold. Timing doesn't work. Says it's going to go up. So you have to have an answer to that. Not you don't have to persuade this other fellow, or that would be nice since he's your friend. But you certainly have to persuade yourself and your own spouse. Your spouse might hear this, and your spouse might come to you and say, honey, you know, I'm glad we invest sensibly. I'm glad, but how about this money on the sidelines thing? Do you ever hear about that? So you have to have an answer. What's the story with the money on the sidelines? It's one of many, many, many arguments made for passive investing that on the surface sounds plausible. It's not a crazy argument. At least it is crazy, but it's not crazy on first inspection. It sounds sensible. But if you look at it, if you understand the ABCs of stock investing, you'll be able to see through it. You'll have X-ray vision, and you'll be able to see through the nonsense, see through the gibberish. So my job is to point out the nonsense, point out the gibberish. What happened with all the money? What this guy was saying on the board the other day is, you know, it's now February 2009. He said, whatever happened to the money on the sidelines that I thought was going to save us? You know, I thought this was a Batman movie. And the Joker's got Batman, you know, under the knife. And at the end of part one, it looks like Batman has met his final doom, but the money on the sidelines is going to come in and save him. But There's no money. No money on the sidelines ever came in. In September, we went down to a P10 of 15. Now we're down at a P10 of 13. Whatever happened to the money on the sidelines anyway? I thought that was going to save us, guys. There's no such thing as money on the sidelines. What's the title of the podcast is? Cash on the sidelines often disappears into nothingness. Well, to understand how it disappears into nothingness, you have to understand where a lot of the money that we talk about in stock came from in the first place. And I remember I wrote an article at the Financial Freedom blog, the earlier version of the blog, that I think the title was just called Poof. I said, where does the money go when stock prices go down? It goes poof. It disappears. The reality is it never existed. And that's what you have to understand. If you understand that, all the rest just follows. But you got to get that. And they talk about investing as if it's all rational and it's all charts and tables. And you get intimidated and you start thinking, forget about common sense. I've got to believe what these experts are telling me. And the experts themselves have fallen for the pixie dust. What you have to ask yourself is this question. In the late 1990s, when prices went to insane levels, stocks were going up by 20 or 30% a year. U.S. productivity has been strong enough to finance an increase in stock returns, a real increase in stock returns, of about 6.5% throughout history. So if the companies are generating enough profits to support a return of 6.5%, and the Dow or the S&P has gone up 25%, where does all the rest of the money come from? If you answer that question, stock investing will begin to make sense for the first time ever in your life. And the answer is that it comes from nowhere. The way stock investing works is, just theoretically, say that Apple Computer today is valued at $9 a share. You look it up in the newspaper, Apple Computer, $9 a share, and say that there's 1 million people who own a share. There's 1 million shares of Apple outstanding. So the total capital, you know, for Apple Computer is 1 million times 9. It's 9 million. But say some guy wakes up this morning and, you know, he meets the girl of his dreams, and, you know, it's a sunny day and life is wonderful, and he goes to his broker and he says, I'm really happy today, I got to tell you. And the broker says, oh, are you? And chats him up. And he says, yeah. And he says, I'm so happy. And he says, I write down all my happy thoughts on my Apple Computer, and I buy stocks with my Apple Computer. I listen to songs on my Apple Computer, and I send my girl love notes on my Apple Computer. And I'm going to use my Apple Computer. Since Apple Computer has made me so happy, I think Apple Computer has a great future, because it's not just me who's going to be happy. Everybody's going to be happy. Now that I'm in love, the whole world is in love. You know? What's that song? Like a big pizza pie in the sky? When the sun hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. The guy thinks everybody's going to be in love come next Wednesday. So he says, no sense bidding $9.50 for Apple stock. I'm going to bid $20. I'm feeling good. I'm not afraid to bid $20. It's going to be $50, $100, $200, I don't know. So the broker accepts the bid, and they give the guy the Apple stock. He buys one share for $20. Big deal. He's out $11. But the trouble is, he's out $11, but the next morning's newspaper says, Apple Computer, $20 per share. And everybody says, ooh, it says it in the newspaper, and it's in a chart. It's got to be true. They wouldn't put it in the newspaper in a chart. And it's in the financial section. It's not in the comics section. It's not in the sports section. It's not in the horoscope section. It's in the financial section. That's the section where they hire the engineer types and the economist types. The ones that, you know, these aren't the people that take English literature in college. They got to take accounting and that hard stuff. Calculus and stuff. God knows what they take. They take courses. They know what they're doing. And it says, look. He points to it. And it says, Apple Computer, $20. And the one guy that bid the $20, he's only out $11. No biggie. But the other million people that own Apple Computer, they're all thinking, hey, yesterday I owned a share of Apple Computer and it was worth $9. Now it's worth $20. I made $11. And there's a million of these people. And so you add them all up and it's 11 million. This guy, just because he happened to meet this girl, this guy who happened to meet this girl who likes Beatles songs, you know, this is what he's been looking for. He's increased the wealth of the United States by $11 million. Just by himself. That's the way it's done, friends and neighbors. That's how we do it in L.A. That's how the newspapers decide to tell you how much your portfolio is worth. So when you get that sheet of paper at the end of the month, it's got six pages and you got to, you know, go. The reason it's got six pages is to make you believe the number in the final page. It's like we got to throw in a lot of numbers in there to make it all seem real and legit, you know. It's all like a little version of Bernie Madoff, you know. People will get mad if I say that. It's not intentional. But I'm just saying, it's sort of like it, because the more paperwork there is, the less you can trust the things written on it. That's going to be a Rob Bennett rule of stock investing. The more pieces of paper they include in the envelope, the less you can believe whatever's written on them. Because they're putting in all these pieces of paper to make it look, you know, scientific, serious, number crunchy. And that number at the bottom, it says, oh, Apple Computer, $20, but it's all nothingness. It doesn't mean anything. If tomorrow, you know, if the girl breaks up with him, he's gonna say, I'll sell this share of Apple at any price. I don't want it anymore. It, you know, thinking about Apple makes me think about her and how she lied about John was her favorite when it was really George all along. She didn't love John. She didn't love me either. She's just a liar. And I don't want this Apple stock anymore. And I'll sell it for 25 cents. And if somebody's willing to buy it probably it won't go to 25 cents, but it'll go to 9. If he offers it for sale at any price, probably since it was worth 9 a couple days ago, it's probably still worth 9. So all those people that thought they made $11, they're back, they lost $11. And so now you have a loss of $11 million instead of a gain, just because this guy and this girl who can't decide whether she likes John or George the best. That's the way we do it in L.A. That's the secret. So the answer is, you know, people think there's cash. There is no cash on the sidelines. If you're talking about money markets, you know, things that are real, you know, then yes, if people move it out of a money market into a, you know, into a, I don't know what, into their mattress, then yes, it's on the sidelines until they put it back into their money market, because they can hold those dollars in their hand and there's something real about them. But there's nothing real about a stock valuation. A stock valuation is whatever we want it to be. If we decide it's $9, it's $9. If we decide it's 20, it's 20. It's whatever we choose. We are the market. And so what happened in the 1990s is we said we're in a mood to destroy our economy. Now, we didn't say that, but that's what we did. We said we're in a mood to destroy our economy, so we're going to bid stock prices up to absolutely insane prices, price levels never seen before in history. And when we're finished doing that, it will feel good for a couple of years. We'll feel a lot richer. The people with those that make those statements will be sending us statements that will make us feel a lot better about our retirement. We know that we've fallen behind, but those statements are going to make us look better. They're going to make us look a lot better. And then, you know, of course, you know, it'll come to pass that we will catch on that the numbers are all wrong. And when we catch on to that, we'll understand that, you know, our retirements were many years behind where we would have been if we hadn't played this game. But we'll deal with that later. You know, that's for the next administration to deal with. So that's what we do. But the point is, there's no such thing as money on the sidelines. Now, there can be. You know, there are circumstances in which there could be money on the sidelines. If stocks are valued at fair value, and people took money out of stocks, then yes, that money could come back into stocks and could push the price up. So I can't say as an absolute rule there can never be money on the sidelines. And I can't say it's not something you should ever think about. But what I'm saying is, at a time when prices are returning to fair value, they're just returning to fair value. It's got nothing to do with money being on the sidelines. Just because people took money out doesn't mean there's any money for them to put back in. It depends, as always, it depends on the valuation level. So the way you have to think about it is, stocks were valued at 3 times fair value in January of 2000. That means that for every dollar in your retirement account, you really had 35 cents. For every $100, you really had $35. For every $1,000, you really had $350. Now, here's an interesting way to think about it. Say that you were paid $1,000 a week at your job. Every week you get a check for $1,000. And say that your saving plan is one of the checks you get every month, the last check of every month. You pay your bills with the first 3 checks. And the fourth check is your savings. You're a good saver. And that fourth check, you put it all into your 401k. So every month you're taking a check for $1,000 and putting it into your 401k. Now, say you're doing this in January of 2000. When stocks were valued, the P10 level was 44. The fair value P10 level is 1415. So stocks are valued at 3 times fair value. And you're putting $1,000 into, you know, you're buying an S&P index fund. What you're doing is, I have to laugh so as not to cry. I'm not laughing at you. Please don't think I am. What you're doing is effectively, you're taking $1,000, handing it to the nice man, you know, or the nice woman, or putting it in an envelope or whatever it is you do. I guess today you're calling on the phone or you're doing it through a computer. But you're essentially taking $1,000 from your account and trading it for an asset worth $350. And you're doing that every month, like clockwork. You're taking $1,000, trading it over, getting an asset worth $350. Now, that sounds insane, doesn't it? Why would any human being ever take an asset worth $1,000, $1,000 check, and hand it over to somebody for an asset worth $350, and then do it again the next month, and the next month, and the next month, and the next month? Could anything be more crazy? So the question you should have is, you know, again, the theme here is questions that, you know, common sense, typical investors ask. You know, Rob, if we're going to believe what you're telling us, you're going to have to explain why, you know, you can't just tell us people are voluntarily handing over assets worth $1,000 and getting assets worth $350 back in return, and they keep doing it. Come on, Rob. You can do better than that. Well, if it were that, you know, if it were that clear, nobody would do it. That is what's happening. But there's a couple things that make it foggy. The biggest thing that makes it foggy is that the experts are all telling us it's a good idea. But let's leave that one aside. I pick on the poor experts enough. There's a couple things that make it foggy. One thing is, if you trade this check valued at $1,000 for, you know, an S&P index fund valued at $350, the truth of the matter is, you could, if you tried to reverse the transaction the next day, they would give you $1,000 back. So you could say, well, Rob, you're wrong. That's if they're willing to give you $1,000 back, that index fund share, those index fund shares, they're worth $1,000. The newspaper got it right, Rob. When they printed $1,000, they were right. You're wrong. You're telling us wrong. You're telling us $350, and they're willing to give you $1,000. Rob, tell the truth. Tell the truth. Well, it's true that they'll give you $1,000. But here's the rub. I hope this turns a key. What if all the holders of the index fund shares came in? Let's say this is a Wednesday. You turned the money in on a Tuesday. You asked for the reversal on Wednesday. Say everybody, or, you know, let's go back to the Apple computer example or whatever you want to do, index fund share, Apple computer, whatever it is. Say that everybody who holds that thing that's worth $1,000 on the same day said, we all want our $1,000 back, not just you. Do you think they would get $1,000 back? They would not. Say there's 100 of us. And we all do what you did. We all put $1,000 in. And we all ask for it back. We say, I want my $1,000 back. I don't feel good with this asset. I want my check back. I want the real stuff. If we all asked for it back, it wouldn't be valued at $1,000. Maybe the first guy, when you get your $1,000, that would lower the rate to maybe, you know, I don't know, $990 or $980. But if lots of people ask for the $1,000 back, the value is going to drop, and it's going to drop, and it's going to drop. And by the time the last of the 100 people ask for their $1,000 back, it's probably going to be worth, well, it's not even going to be worth $350. You know, it's going to be worth maybe $150. Maybe $175. In other words, the amount that you get back depends on how many people ask for it back. Because each time somebody asks for it back, the value falls. Because each time somebody asks for it back, it's the equivalent of, you know, the thing that happened with the Apple share guy, that, you know, his girlfriend broke up with him and he's feeling sad, and sadness makes stock prices go down. It's so stupid and yet so important. It's 70% emotional. You see, they report the numbers as if they're serious, as if, you know, these people are doctors or something, and, you know, this went through an MRI machine, you know, and it's all serious as all get out, but the numbers are determined by the most frivolous of human emotions. People just on a whim pay $20 for Apple and $11 million is created out of thin air. And then on a whim, they sell it and $11 million is gone. And that is the way it works. Check it out. Don't take my word for it. Check it out. Ask hard questions. And you'll see that what I'm saying is so. So when you say I'm a liar, that if the guy wanted to, he could get his $1,000 back on Wednesday. Well, yes and no. It's true that if he was the only one who did it, he could get his money back. But if more, you know, he doesn't control what other people do. So if he could control the whole world, it would work. But he can't control the whole world. And when the rest of the world decides they want their money back, your money isn't worth as much. So we're all in this together. And what I argue for is something called rational investing. I argue for letting people know the rules of the game. Because if people understand the rules of the game, what the experts always say is, oh, if we tell people how it works, they'll get nervous. They'll get anxious. They'll get scared. They'll all be scaredy cats. And I say just the opposite. I say if the more people know about how investing works, the less scared they're going to be. What makes people scared is when you start telling them that their retirement account is worth three times what it really is worth. Because somewhere in the back of their head, even though they're going along, they're being bullied, they're being intimidated into going along with what you're saying, but somewhere deep in their hearts, they know that it's BS. We all have common sense. And so somewhere deep in their hearts, they start to have fears. And these fears can't be spoken aloud. That's against the rules. So they get more scared. And eventually they get so scared that they just say, I'm going to take my money out. I don't even know why. I can't figure out why, but I just got a bad feeling. And now we're off to the races. In other words, they make, by keeping all the reality secret from people, they make stock investing more risky than it has to be. They increase the risk by five times. They make it far more risky because it's all emotion. Whereas if you tell people the truth, you diminish the emotion. People sort of know what the deal is, and they take that into account, and they've got something solid to go by. But you tell people all this gibberish, these marketing slogans, and all you do is you plant seeds of doubt within. And when the seeds of doubt grow to fruition, there ain't a thing you can do about it. And you can stand there and you can say, cash on the sidelines, cash on the sidelines. But there ain't no cash on the sidelines. The money disappeared. The money was never there in the first place. It's emotion. It's cotton candy. It's nothingness. And it has returned to nothingness. Now, the other question that people will have is they'll say, well, Rob, okay, you've explained about why they'll give you $1,000 on Wednesday, and all right, your answer kind of makes sense, I guess. I guess we'll let you know, I don't know, Rob. I don't believe everything you say, but maybe a little bit right. Maybe just a tiny bit. But I've got another problem, Rob. You're saying if I give $1,000 and stocks are valued at P1044, I'm getting $1,000, and I'm only getting an asset worth $350 back, right? Isn't that what you're saying? Yes. Well, how come if you look at the long-term return on stocks, it's 6.5% real. Even you admit that, Rob. Even a guy that dresses the way you do admits that much and has glasses like those stupid glasses you have. Even that person admits that much. Yes. Yes. 6.5 is right. Well, if I'm getting an asset only worth $350, how is it stocks pay 6.5% real? Well, that's another one of those complications. It's true that if you buy stocks when they're valued three times fair value, you're giving up an asset, a check worth $1,000, and getting an asset, a stock index worth $350. But that asset worth $350 has great earnings potential. So what happens is, if you hold that asset for 30 years, there are going to be times, like the time you made the transaction, when that asset is only worth $350. But there are going to be other times when that asset's going to zoom ahead in value, and there are going to be times when it's undervalued. And at the end of 30 years, you mix up the times when stocks are overvalued and the times when they're undervalued, and you're going to get a return of 6.5. In other words, there are going to be times when stocks are going to earn far less than 6.5% real for 10-year time periods, like the 10-year time period we've just been through. But there are going to be other times when they earn far more. And at the end of 30 years, you might not have 6.5 exactly. The most likely return for 30 years, starting in January of 2000, is 5.4. So it's not 6.5, but for practical purposes, I think it's close enough. If you go 60 years out, it gets real close. I don't know what I think the number's about 6.2 or 6.3. In other words, the farther you go out, the closer you'll get to that 6.5 number. But don't expect 6.5 in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years or 20 years. That's what the passive investing people lead you to believe. That's the danger. That's what makes stock investing dangerous. These tall tales that you can invest it in, you can expect it in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years or 20 years, those are false expectations. That's not likely to happen. And it's dangerous to lead people on that way. But 30 years, you'll be in that neighborhood. Maybe not quite 6.5, but close enough, I think. Think about, and I'm going to use very loose numbers here. I'm not going to be at all scientific. I'm just going to try to make a point, you know, without getting into the details, without being accurate, but just sort of giving you a rough idea what happens. If you buy stocks in January of 2000, when the market was valued at 3x fair value, you're exchanging a check worth $1,000 for an asset worth $350. So you've lost, you know, 65% of your money. You've had a loss of 65%. Now, but you're buying an asset that ordinarily produces gains of 6.5% a year beyond inflation. Well, take 6.5 and multiply by 10 years. You've got 65. So you're buying an asset that the transaction causes you to lose 65% of your money, but if that asset performs as it always has in the past, you're going to have a gain of 65% in 10 years. So in a very loose sense, these numbers don't really work this way, but I'm greatly oversimplifying. In a very simple way, you could say, you're getting a 65% loss on the day you make the transaction, and you're getting a 65% gain over the course of 10 years. And what does the stock return predictor tell you at the end of 10 years? It tells you the most likely result is you will lose 1% real per year on average for 10 years. And that's about what you come to using those very loose numbers that are not, you know, not calculated properly. But in other words, you're losing 65% on the day you buy the stocks. But stocks are such a great asset class that at the end of 10 years, you've gained it all back. So you're basically where you started. So when you buy stocks at the prices that they were selling from 1995 through 2008, what you're really doing is you're saying, I'm going to put my money in a place where I won't have any gains for 10 years, and I'll probably have a small loss, but not anything real big. There'll be some good years, there'll be some bad years. Obviously, in 2008, you had a bad year. You know, maybe you lost 40%. But you're going to have some good years mixed in. Maybe not in the first 10 years. Maybe from 2000 to 2010, there won't, you know, it won't break even. But if you hold on a couple more years, to 2012, 2013, you're going to eventually break even. Okay? So there's different factors, influencing the result here. The one factor, the thing working against you, is you bought stocks at such insanely dangerous prices. But the other factor that always counters it is stocks are such a wonderful asset class. What rational investing is all about, you know, passive investing is the approach that says ignore all the realities. Stocks are such a great asset class, just always buy them, forget about the price. So what if you're throwing your money away, 65% of it? So what? Just do it. Don't think, do it. Rational investing says, wait a minute, yes, stocks are a wonderful asset class, but why not do it rationally? Why not, not put so much money into stocks when they're 3 times fair value? Put your money into tips that were paying 4% real per year back in 2000. And then, you know, lock in that 4% real return. And then when stocks go down to fair value, then buy stocks. When you know, you're getting $1,000 of value back in exchange for your $1,000. You see the difference? You can buy a whole lot more stocks if you don't buy heavily during the price, you know, before the price crash. Most people worry about buying stocks after the price crash. The time to worry is before the price crash. And the passive investors will tell you you can't know when the price crash is coming, and they're just wrong. You can know. All you have to do is look at the price. Stocks always crash when they're at the price levels they were at from 95 through 2008. The only troublesome thing is a lot of people want them to crash immediately. And if they don't crash immediately, they get impatient. They give up and they buy. They don't always crash immediately. It can take time. But they always crash. And as long as you know they're going to crash, you don't really need to be heavily invested in them. You should be putting your money somewhere else, earning a good return somewhere else so that you can buy more stocks after they crash. That's how you make money in the long term. So the other reason why it fools people, it seems so stupid to give up $1,000 asset for an asset worth $350, but the reason why a lot of smart people get fooled is that $350 asset provides great returns. And held long enough, it provides returns great enough to make up for the stupid decision to pay $1,000 for it. In other words, no matter how stupid it is to buy stocks, in time it will come to be a good thing. It may take 30 years, but in time it will come to be a good thing. And even after 10 years, it won't look quite so bad. You know, a lot of people are thinking now buying stocks, you know, if they've bought stocks from, say, 1999 forward, they're thinking, that looks like a really bad thing I did. Well, it looks bad today. But in another 5 years, it might not look quite so bad. Another 10 years, it might start to look good. Another 15 years, I think the odds are it'll start to look good. The longer you hold, the better it's going to look. Where I differ, and a lot of that is what the passive investing people will tell you, but where they go wrong is saying, you should ignore price. You know, that's going too far. It's fine to say that the longer you hold stocks, the better they look. That I can go along with. That's an important insight. But the mistake is saying buy them at any price. That's crazy talk. Dangerous, crazy, reckless talk. That I can't buy into. Now, this principle that valuation matters is, of course, the principle that came into effect in the, you know, in the safe withdrawal rate studies. This is the error that was made, you know, that caused the safe withdrawal rate studies to be wrong. And I think I'm going to explore that. I think I'm going to leave that one for a thinking of recording a podcast on what I call probability investing, which is really just another name for rational investing. It's investing by looking at the probabilities. And I had a note here to discuss the safe withdrawal rate topic in connection with this podcast. I'm thinking that might fit better on the podcast on probability investing. So I think I'm going to wrap this one up, and amazingly enough, I may actually pull one in at under 60 minutes. It's been a long time since I was able to pull one in at under 60 minutes, but I think that's a good thing. It'd be good if I could start to make these shorter. But the point here is, a lot of people, just to wrap it up, a lot of people have been thinking that when the price crash caused people to get out of stocks, that money went on the sidelines somewhere. And it was sitting around waiting to jump into stocks, waiting to push stock prices up. And it doesn't work that way. It can. It can be a factor. So I can't say that it never happens that way. But the bigger factor is this cotton candy factor. The question of, was the stock price a reflection of economic reality or not? And to the extent that the answer is no, it was not a reflection of economic reality, then all that's happening when prices drop, it's not that people are leaving stocks and they're going to come back in. It's that the money in stocks, the value is returning to fair levels. That's what's causing the price drop. It's not that there's cash on the sidelines. It's that there's less cotton candy in the price. And this is the central principle of rational investing, evaluation-informed indexing. Because what it's all about, as I say, it's about assessing the probabilities. You want to know when are the probabilities on my side, when are the probabilities against me. And see, what I would say is, when you buy stocks, when you're exchanging $1,000, a check worth $1,000, and you're getting $350 of value back, I'd say the value proposition is pretty darn poor. The odds are against you. You're going to have to wait 10 years. Even in 10 years, the odds are against you breaking even. If you hold 15 years, the odds are, say you're probably going to break even. But breaking even isn't going to make you very happy, because if you're 45 years old and you're hoping to retire at 65, 15 years to break even, you're going to be falling behind on your retirement plan. And every year you go, just breaking even is a year you fall further behind what you had hoped to do. A lot of people, I know I did this in the days when I believed in passive investing, they have these computer programs and they plug in. I'm sure they're still around. I haven't used one in years and years, but I did when I was younger. And, you plug in how much you're saving every month, and they tell you, at this rate, if you continue to earn 6.5 a year, you'll end up by age 65 with, 2 million or whatever it is. Well, all those numbers are wildly wrong, because they don't look at, most of these calculators don't look at valuations. Maybe a couple out there do, but I'm not familiar with them. The ones I was using didn't do it, that I recall. So the calculator's assuming you're going to be earning whatever. I think you can plug in different numbers. You can plug in 6% or 7%. Some people probably plug in 10%, But every year that you go earning a negative 1%, which is what you should realistically expect to earn when you buy stocks at the prices that apply during the crazy years, every year you earn a negative 1%, you're going to get more anxious, because you're falling farther and farther and farther behind. So what I would say is, don't do that. If you feel that you want to put 20% in stocks, that's not going to hurt you that much. That can make sense. I think that can be a good thing. It's healthy to have some money in the game. Keep you paying attention to stocks, keep you learning. And in the event we have some of those temporary, jumps forward, jumps up, you'll be involved. You won't feel left out. So I think a 20%, 30% allocation, even at the prices that applied from 95 through 2008, makes all the sense in the world. I have no problem with it. Where I get off the reservation is where people start talking about 60% allocations and 70% allocations and, God help us all, 80% allocations. That's crazy talk. That's reckless, dangerous stuff. And that's what's causing this economic crisis, that 90% of the experts were recommending crazy talk, crazy stuff. And we have middle-class people investing in stocks for their retirements, and we need to start giving them responsible advice. It's important. But in order to, for the responsible advice to click, you need to understand these ABCs. And the ABC is, you can't treat stocks as if there's something real, as if, people take money out, they sit it on the sidelines, and that money's going to get back in. You have to understand that stocks are a combination of real things, hard things, numbers, economic realities, and soft, gooey emotions. And that's just the way it is. That's what stocks are. You know, you don't have to like it, but you have to acknowledge it if you want to be an effective investor. And the only way you're ever, the way to deal with the, let's call it a problem, I think everyone would acknowledge that the emotional realities of stock investing are a problem. It would all be so much simpler if it weren't there. The emotions is the stuff that scares us. Well, the way the passive investors deal with that problem is they say, ignore it. Pretend it doesn't exist. Pretend that the market's efficient. Why not? Well, the problem with that is clicking your heels three times and saying, the market is efficient. The market is efficient. The market is efficient. Doesn't make it so. It's never been efficient. It's not possible for the rational human mind to imagine how it ever could become efficient. So why imagine that it is? I say, deal with the realities. The reality is, it's always partly efficient and partly emotional. And the only way you can know how efficient it is and how emotional it is to look at the PE10 level. That tells you. That's what it was created to do. So when you look at the PE10 level, you know what sort of long-term value proposition do stocks provide. And from 1995 through the first part of 2008, the value proposition was horrible, frighteningly horrible. Today, it's pretty good. You might have losses for 5 years, but the long-term value proposition is good. The long-term value proposition is good at today's price levels. So, cash on the sidelines often disappears into nothingness. Don't count on cash on the sidelines to bring stock prices back up anytime soon. I'd love to hear your thoughts. If you have any to share that you're willing to share, please use the Contact Rob button at the left side of every page at the website, passionsaving.com. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.